MacCast, Monday, November 9th, 2015. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode, and it's going to be a pretty good one. I think in the news, we've got all of the usual suspects represented. So Apple TV stuff to talk about, a possible update to Mac desktops, also updates to the iPhone coming around the corner, at least the rumors of what's going to be next, even some updates on Apple's car project, and the big news of the week, which is the iPad Pro, which should be here hopefully by the end of the week, but we're going to get into some of the details and information about that. And then we've got your comments and feedback, some questions about Apple TV versus Mac media centers using a Mac Mini as a home theater setup. How's that compare versus the Apple TV? A little tip on Apple Watch notifications. What happens if you are not happy with El Capitan and you want to roll back maybe to Yosemite? We're going to get into how you might be able to do that or why you might want to do that. And then still some troubles getting in at the Genius Bar. We're going to have some hints and tips and tricks on how to get in if you need some Apple support. And then also finish up with a little commentary, some questions about the quality of cables, both for the Mac and for iOS. So should be a good show. Stay tuned for that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Gazelle is a place where you can go to sell your old iPhone, iPad, your old Apple gear, and get cash for it. If you haven't tried out Gazelle in the past, and you have some old gear that you want to sell, I would really recommend you go check them out. I have been using Gazelle for years. I've sold many an iPhone back to them and a couple of iPads, I think. And what I really like about them is how easy they make the process. And you've got that new iPad Pro coming up, so maybe you want to pick up one of those. Maybe you want a new Apple TV. If you have an old device you're not using, why not sell it to Gazelle? All you have to do is go on their website, gazelle.com. You answer a few easy questions like, what is the device you have? What kind of condition is it in? What accessories do you still have with it? And right there, they will give you an instant price quote. And there's no obligation, so you really have nothing to lose. You can still look at the offer. If you want to try a private sale, something like that, you can do it. But I have a feeling you're going to like the idea of giving it or selling it back to Gazelle. And they will even buy broken devices. So don't worry if it's broken. They'll give you an offer on that too. They include free shipping, and in many cases, you can get a box to send it in. I choose that option quite frequently because they send you all the materials you need. You get that in the mail, you drop your product in there and shoot it back to them. It could not be simpler. And once they receive the device, they check it out, make sure it matches the condition that you said it was, and they will even wipe all of the personal information off of it, and then you get paid fast and easy. And there's a lot of options for that as well. You can get a check in the mail. You can get direct deposit to your PayPal account. You can even opt for an Amazon gift card, and you get a little more on your offer if you choose that option. That's actually my favorite one. Gazelle has served over 1 million customers. They've paid out over $200 million. They are trustworthy and reliable. I really do like them, and you can get cash for your old device. So what are you waiting for? Go to gazelle.com today, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Apple Insider this week noticed something very interesting on the App Store. They came across an app called the Indoor Survey app. It was actually spotted, I think, by developer Steve Stratton Smith, and hopefully I'm not mutilating his name, but I probably am. And it was interesting because it was sort of there available for everyone, but it turns out what it is it's part of Apple's mapping program, and specifically something called Map Connect. And Map Connect is a service where you can go to a website, you can register if you have a business, and then manage the listing for your business or businesses, I guess, within Apple Maps. So it gives small business owners a way to kind of make sure that their data is correct on Apple Maps. And Apple is adding a new service they're calling Indoor. And it's coupled with this indoor survey app that will allow retailers to go in and map the interiors of their business. Now, I don't think any of this data is available currently on Apple Maps, but it looks like they're gearing up to actually have it available. On the Apple Maps Connect site, it does say that they are limiting businesses right now for at least this service to just a few. I guess there's been a huge demand since this story broke for people wanting to do indoor mapping of their businesses. And Apple says the business needs to be accessible to the general public. They need to have annual visits of 1 million visitors per year. They have to have availability of complete, accurate, and scaled reference maps. I would assume that would mean like layout maps of the business. They need to have Wi-Fi enabled because the way this thing gets mapped, which we'll explain here in a minute, is through Wi-Fi and radio frequencies and stuff like that. And they do need to have the app associated with the venue of the owner of the business. So I would assume that is whoever registered with the Apple Map Connect program. And once you are all kind of set up and ready to go, I guess the way this works is the app is used by participants to go through their business and mark locations. So they can drop points on a map of the building to indicate their position. And as they walk through, the indoor survey app measures the RF signal in that region and combines it with some of the iPhone sensor data. And apparently that allows Apple to get an accurate indoor positioning without the retailer or the location needing to install special hardware like GPS or iBeacons. iBeacons was supposed to be one of those solutions for this, but for a small business, it can get a little bit pricey to have to install and maintain and deal with all of these iBeacons. So this would be a way around it where they could simply give staff or people iPhones, have them go around and do this mapping without requiring any extra technology. So pretty cool stuff. And it's very likely that the technology Apple is leveraging here is stuff they acquired from a company called Wi-Fi Slam in 2013. They actually purchased that company, and that company claimed that they could identify where you were in a building within about 8 feet by combining technologies like Wi-Fi triangulation, Bluetooth beacons, and other smartphone sensor data. So that's probably what's going on here, which means for us, it could be an addition to Apple Maps at some point in the future, hopefully pretty soon, because it sounds like they're ramping this program up. And again, the app appears to have just sort of surfaced on the App Store. So I would look forward to that. I don't know if it's going to be coming in the current version of iOS, a part of an iOS 9 update, or maybe it'll be in iOS 10 come next year. I'm guessing it'll probably be a big new feature part of Apple Maps and iOS 10, which I would assume we would hear about at WWDC in June of 2016. Well, the Apple TV has been out for a week or so now, and now that it's in the hands of guys like me and you and also reviewers online, we're starting to learn a lot more about what the Apple TV can do, and Apple seems to be updating some of the software, adding some additional features to kind of address some of the issues that a lot of us had as early complaints. And one of those was with the App Store and just trying to find or discover apps. It's still a pretty kludgy process right now, but this past week, Apple did add a top section. So you can see top paid, free, and top grossing apps. It tends to right now mirror a lot of the front page, I think, because that's really how you can discover stuff. We're still really sitting here waiting for a nice browse option. Apple hasn't really opened that up yet, but they did add categories or start to add categories, but just two categories exist right now, games and entertainment. It's great, you know, it's a good start, but Apple needs to take things a lot further. Sort of unrelated, Apple did recently also add a shopping category to the iOS App Store, and I was surprised that Apple TV didn't get a shopping category as well, because there's apps on the Apple TV like QVC and I think Gilt and some other shopping apps that would fit really well into a shopping category. But for right now, you have games and entertainment categories on the Apple TV. If you don't see it on your Apple TV, it sounds like some users have had to just simply restart the Apple TV, or at the very least go in, double tap the TV button so that you can get to the app switcher. and close down the App Store app if it's been open and then just reopen it. And that should force down, sort of clear the cache and force down the update if you're not seeing these two new categories. But even within the categories, to me, in playing around with it, you can't really drill in or browse through things. It's really just kind of those featured apps. So you have that there. With the new top data, developer Stephen Trotten-Smith, and you're going to hear a lot about him. He's been playing around apparently a lot with the Apple TV. Something he did notice with the new top data, top paid specifically, is that a lot of the apps on the Apple TV seem to be slightly higher in price than what we would normally see on the iOS App Store. And that could be good for developers. A lot of the titles, and I looked at this myself, seem to be ranging between $2.99 US and $9.99 US. And there are very few 99 cent titles. Of course, you have the free section, but not a lot of dollar titles that I'm seeing, at least currently. So the theory here is that maybe the Apple TV will push back on some of that race to the bottom pricing that we saw on iOS. And you know, if you've listened to this show, that I feel developers are really undervaluing their applications, and it's just been this competition. And I don't think that's good for the longevity of app development. We want our app developers to make great apps, and we want to pay them a fair value, a fair market rate for that. So will the Apple TV be able to sort of shift things around? I don't know. I think part of the reason, too, the Apple TV is getting a little higher price point is one of the main categories is games, right? And games typically have a little bit higher pricing in the App Store, at least for the higher quality games from bigger developers. They tend to have a higher price point of like $4.99, $9.99 and up. And so I think that's translating over to the Apple TV as well. There's certainly no shortage of shovelware apps, things like tic-tac-toe, fireplaces. There's like a million fireplace apps. It's the fart and flashlight app of the Apple TV. You know, this, you can buy an app and it'll just display a fireplace on your TV, which I guess, you know, is handy and useful for people who like that sort of thing. There's also been sort of variations on that, environment generators, so you can kind of have beach scenes with beach sounds and things like that, or maybe a nice forest scene. And then I've also seen a bunch of aquarium apps surfacing. So I guess something to display on your Apple TV, or on your television rather, via the Apple TV when you're not really using it. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with the App Store. Stephen Trotten-Smith has also been experimenting a lot with the tvOS, and he's figured out a few things. One of them specifically that is very interesting is that you can create folders for applications just like you would on iOS. Obviously, Apple hasn't enabled that feature, and it's kind of unclear how you would actually create the folder because, you know, on iOS, you've got to drag one icon on top of the other. On the Apple TV, you can press and hold on the icon to move it around and then redrop it, reposition it, but you really can't put one on top of the other. They just sort of slide out of the way. So that would have to be worked out. But the folders do behave just like they do on iOS, and you can even customize the names. I think folders may not make sense for the Apple TV interface, though. So while you could do it technically, I think I'd rather have the ability to kind of have separate tabs, or really just separate pages where I could categorize. I could have categorized pages with just the icons, sort of in the same way that Apple's adding categories to the App Store. So if I could have a games page and a entertainment page and maybe a shopping page, that would work for me, and just have the appropriate apps on each one of those little pages. And you wouldn't need a ton of them, I don't think. I think that would be the better way to go. But at the very least, it seems like folders may be doable. And as we get more apps on the Apple TV, managing and sorting and keeping track of those things, you are going to need a little more than just one giant page of scrolling banner icons, I think. Smith also developed a hack for the Apple TV that would allow it to run a web browser. It's currently using a private API, so Apple would never really approve it on the App Store. It uses Apple's UI WebView class. But he posted the project on GitHub, and then another Dutch developer posted a demo video showing a version that he claimed was quote-unquote forked from Smith's project, although Smith did comment on Twitter that just changing a cursor graphic and changing click versus tap doesn't really constitute forking an app, and I would agree with that. But there was a video, Cult of Mac highlighted it, And it does point out that should Apple open up their API or allow developers to tap into that, technically we could see developers making browser apps for the Apple TV. That excites some people. For me, I just come back and go, really, why would we want to do that? Over and over again, I think throughout the ages, starting all the way back with web TV, it's been proven that the web experience isn't really built or doesn't really work very well on an Apple TV. I think a lot of people would like it for accessing certain web-based content that maybe doesn't have a dedicated Apple TV app. So I guess it could get you through in a pinch, but I really think a true app experience that's designed for the screen that you're viewing stuff on is the appropriate way to go, which is why Apple may never open up, I think, the web APIs, at least for tvOS. But I could be proven wrong, and it looks like at least technically it's able to be done. Thank goodness Dropgate on the Siri remote really hasn't become a thing. I think I mentioned this last time. If you remember, there was a Reddit poster who claimed that he had his Siri remote shattered when it fell 2 feet from the couch onto a tile floor. The internet, though, has not seemed to have exploded with others claiming the same fate for their Siri remote. And I haven't heard from anyone who has said they have broken their Siri remote. I did some poking around, and in fact, I could only find one other report in a YouTube video that was posted on November 2nd. And I'm not 100% sure it wasn't the remote from the same guy. It was kind of hard to tell from the pictures. It is glass. I mean, the trackpad's glass, the front of it's glass. So I would think, you know, a drop in sort of landing the right way on a hard surface, it could potentially break. But I fully expected a whole rash of like drop test videos for Siri remotes to show up on YouTube, and not a single one has. So I think it's not really going to be a thing. But Griffin is actually making a case for the Siri remote. They call it the Survivor Play. It's $19.99 US. It's coming soon, but they announced that actually before the Apple TV was even shipping. So I think it was more focused on giving you a Wiimote style case because you can use the Apple remote or the Siri remote to play games using the accelerometer. The concern would be you're throwing it around. You don't want to accidentally have it fly out of your hand and hit your buddy in the head, right? So this is a nice silicone protective case that can go around it. It would protect it also, I would assume, from drops and things like that, although it doesn't really cover the front. So if it, again, fell on a hard surface in the right direction, I think it could still potentially shatter. But just in case, you probably don't want to toss out your old Apple TV remote either, because the new Apple TV, while the Siri remote uses Bluetooth, it still does have IR built into it. So you can actually pair and still use your older remotes with the Apple TV. And some people have commented this week that they actually prefer using that remote because you can do the little directional clicks rather than having to swipe around on the trackpad. Some people have not enjoyed the trackpad experience. I personally like it. And another little handy tip, though, is you can actually click in the different areas, top, bottom, left, or right, rather than swiping to navigate around the interface. It actually will recognize clicks on the edges of the trackpad. So give that a shot if you're kind of missing the old up, down, left, right navigation of your old Apple remote, or just, you know, pair that old remote with the Apple TV. Now, another thing people immediately noticed was missing from the Apple TV in terms of apps is the podcast app. And for me, that's a pretty important app. You obviously listen to podcasts, so it's probably one that you may or may not use as well. I personally never use the podcast app on my Apple TV. I prefer to do it on my iPhone when I'm in the car, or just through iTunes when I'm sitting at my desk. But a lot of people apparently like to run podcasts through maybe their home stereo system as they're walking around the house. And it'd be nice for that to be there. It'd also be good for video podcasts. I guess as an audio podcaster, it doesn't concern me as much. But if you did a video podcast, you would want people to watch your podcast on the Apple TV. I'm sure we're going to get some third-party podcast apps here very soon, but it certainly seems like a big oversight on Apple's part. Even more curious, though, is that Cult of Mac readers have noticed that the demo reel of the Apple TV running on new Apple TVs in Apple retail stores clearly shows a podcast app in the user interface. So the question is, was it there at some point, or is Apple planning on bringing it out. We haven't heard anything related to iOS 9.1, which is currently in development, and developers have had that. So it's kind of confusing. Did someone at Apple just add that podcast app as a creative decision and it wasn't anything that was really thought about? My guess is that Apple does plan to have a podcast app on the Apple TV, and it should be coming soon. Hopefully it'll just show up in the App Store at some point and you'll be able to download it and sync it through your iCloud and everything else. Why it wasn't there on day one, though, still a little bit of a mystery. And then the last thing we heard on the Apple TV this week is a little bit more about why Siri is probably only available in 8 countries at launch. So Apple did launch the Apple TV with Siri support, but they launched in many more countries than they're actually supporting with Siri. We've talked about this a little bit on the show. Well, this week, a site called Mac Prime says that they actually had a chance to ask some of the managers on the Apple TV team why this was. And according to them, Apple claims it's because the pronunciation of things like actors' names and show names is very specific, and the pronunciations can vary widely from region to region and dialect to dialect. And they wanted to make sure that Siri would be able to comprehend and respond appropriately when you ask for a certain actor or a title or try to get that information. And that makes a lot of sense. I've often heard complaints from you that Siri has issues with common dictionary words and phrases on the iPhone in countries that have thick or very regionalized accents. So while it might be able to understand one accent in a region, if you're in another region that has a very different dialect, it can sometimes fail. So apparently they're taking the extra time to make sure that they adapt words and phrases specifically related to the large catalog of, you know, movies and TV shows that they have available in iTunes to make sure that it works when they roll it out in different countries. So the managers did say that they were hard at work trying to bring Siri support to other countries, but they unfortunately stopped short of giving any actual projected dates. So don't know how quickly or how soon Siri support may roll out for Apple TV in your country if you don't have it currently. But good news is they are working on it. The Mac Pro hardware has not been updated in about 2 years. And we discussed last time on the MacCast that many Mac Pro users are getting a little bit antsy. Mac Pro users, meaning Mac professional users, they're getting a little bit antsy about what Apple is doing in the Pro market and wondering how Apple is going to support Pro users. And a big part of that is, when are they going to update the Mac Pro, put some new hardware together? Well, this past week, Mac Rumors found a blog post for a guy who found a reference to what looks like a new Mac in the code for El Capitan. And that code name that he discovered was very close to the current generation model of Mac Pro. The code name was AAPLJ95,1, and the current Mac Pro is AAPLJ90,1. So difference between 90 and 95. And let's face it, it's due for a refresh. So it's a pretty safe assumption to think that, hey, maybe Apple has a new Mac Pro in the works. Now, this reference was found in a KX file, a kernel extension file called Apple USB X HCI PCI, which in this one section looks like it lists out the number of USB ports for that model Mac. Now, something interesting about this entry is it shows a whopping 10 USB 3 ports. Not sure what that's all about. I don't think Apple's going to put out a Mac Pro with 10 USB 3 ports. But it does seem something that would be more likely destined for a Pro model Mac than maybe necessarily an iMac. Now, the person who did discover this reference did note that it looks identical to the reference for the late 2015 iMac 7,1. It was in the same file and says maybe it could be just a remnant of that left over when they released the new iMac. But there is separate data in this reference file for the 2015 iMac. So you would think if they removed that, they would have removed the code name as well. As far as what a new Mac Pro might look like, there's some speculation out there after this report came out. Many think that Apple will update it to the newer Intel Xeon Broadwell EP processors. that they would significantly update the graphics to be based on AMD's new Fury platform, that we would get the faster flash storage and faster memory, and that Apple possibly could add in Apple Thunderbolt 3 and support for the newer USB-C ports. I think Thunderbolt 2 might still stick around in a next-gen Mac Pro. I'm not sure where they're at with Thunderbolt 3, but for sure I think an update to USB-C would make sense, and I don't know if that ties back into the fact that this entry had a strange 10 USB 3 port listing. But regardless, it looks like something might be happening with the Mac Pro fairly soon, and a lot of people are going to say it's been about time. Now, normally I would immediately dismiss this next rumor because it's just something I don't think Apple is going to do. But the fact that it comes from this specific source has caused me to decide that we probably should talk about it. What's happening is KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, who has a pretty good track record with Apple rumors, says that Apple is planning to make a new version of a 4-inch iPhone. So basically, it would be a significant update to the current iPhone 5S that Apple sells. And Kuo says it would arrive sometime in the first half of 2016. So the theory here is that there is still a number of Apple customers who maybe haven't upgraded to an iPhone, or maybe even Android customers who want an iPhone, but they don't want the bigger 4.7 or 5.5-inch version. They're very happy with a 4-inch size device. And I think I've heard from some people who are in that same boat. They really like the current size, and they've been holding on to maybe their 5 or 5S, and Apple could, by making another device, appeal to those customers. Again, I don't think that's something that's going to happen, but Ming-Chi Kuo does. So what would that device look like? Well, beyond a significant update and metal casing that he mentions, he didn't offer many more details, but others have used that to kind of make some informed guesses. We know the screen size would remain at 4 inches. The assumption is it would get updated to a A9 processor, that it would include Touch ID, but no Force Touch. So it sounds like Apple would price it out and sort of target it at the lower or entry level side of the iPhone ecosystem. And I think that does make sense. In the same note, Kuo also said he expects the usual refresh for the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus to happen sometime in the fall. It will probably feature an updated A10 processor. He says that Apple will keep the RAM the same in the iPhone 7 at 2 gigabytes, but they could possibly jump up 1 gigabyte in the 7 Plus to 3 gigabytes to help with performance. There's been a big debate this time around whether or not Apple will lose the home button finally. We heard some of those rumors going into the iPhone 6 and even the 6S and 6S Plus updates. Didn't happen. I think the home button is going to be around for a long, long time. But some people think that Apple wants to go with a digital version, build it into the glass display. And there have been some recent rumors that Apple is developing its own touch and display driver integration, TDDI, touch and display driver integration chips, so that they could do exactly that, get rid of the home button. But I think it will stick around at least for one more generation, if maybe not longer. And we did hear some reports that Apple was struggling with that display driver integration, so that could slow things down a little bit. So that it may just, you know, not come this generation because they can't get the technology quite sorted out. But I'm curious, what do you think? Do you think the home button needs to go away? I like having the one physical button. I've messed around with Android phones. You know, they have those digital kind of glass buttons. I don't know what you call them. Never really was very happy with that. I still like that nice clickable feel, knowing that I'm pressing something and I'm getting back to that home screen. Now, I personally think that Apple will maintain the current release cycle of launching a new phone in the fall, but there are some contradictory rumors floating around Apple Insider claims that they have a reliable source that told them Apple might release the iPhone 7 updates sooner. And while they didn't say how much sooner, you can look to the past to think maybe Apple will go back to that summer release cycle. If you remember, prior to the iPhone 4S, Apple generally did launch a new iPhone in late June, early July timeframe. And the reported Apple Insider is claiming that Apple might want to bump up the iPhone launch to stay ahead of sales that typically slow near the end of the current iPhone's production cycle. So kind of get ahead of that and keep things going, spread things out a little bit more. And I think that would make sense. If they could get to the point where they're launching iPhones a little bit further back from maybe new iPads or updated Apple TVs, I think they need to get back into the cycle where they have kind of something happening every quarter that's pretty big. I've not been a big fan, and you probably know this if you've been listening to the show, of the big giant launches where we get everything all at once. It's kind of hard on consumers' pocketbooks, and I think, you know, to a certain degree, that probably affects sales. Maybe Apple doesn't think so, but I know for me, it would be a hard decision if I wasn't having to do it for business to kind of, you know, continually buy products and have to buy them all at once. So a little bit more spread out would be a good thing, I think, for consumers. The current generation iPhone sales continue to be strong for Apple. We know they just had that great past quarter selling a lot of iPhones, and that international sales are becoming increasingly more important. China is a big market for Apple. Well, also an up-and-coming market appears to be Vietnam, and Apple reportedly opened up a subsidiary country in the region to expand sales there. Apparently, they established it at the end of October, and it's called Apple Vietnam Limited Liability, and the company will directly import and distribute iPhones in Vietnam. And while it's not the largest country in terms of area or population, it is one of Apple's fastest growing markets. As a matter of fact, Apple tripled sales there in the first half of the year. That's a quicker rate than they are expanding in China, and they obviously want to sell more, so they're setting up this company. And while the smartwatch and wearables hasn't become a huge giant market like the iPhone, it's still doing pretty well for Apple, at least according to some of the recent numbers. Research firm Canalysis says that they believe Apple shipped almost 7 million Apple Watches since they launched, and they say that Apple was the only smartwatch vendor to ship more than 300,000 units in Q3 of 2015, and they shipped a lot more than 300,000. We're talking in the millions, so they're far outselling, or far out shipping at least, the competition. And if the total number is accurate, the 7 million is accurate, Apple has shipped more than all other smartwatch vendors combined for the past 5 quarters. That figure may be a little higher, I think, than some other estimates we've seen, but most still seem to think Apple has sold somewhere in the excess of 5 million Apple Watches. And that's really not too shabby for the smartwatch market. So they're commanding a big chunk of that market, and they did just start up sales this past week in India, which is another big market, so expect that to drive up numbers for the next quarter. That combined with the holidays, I think Apple is going to be doing just fine with Apple Watch sales. Unfortunately, again, they don't break those out in their quarterly results. They're part of the other category, along with iPods and other accessories, including Beats headphones. So it's really hard to gauge how much Apple is selling in terms of the Apple Watch market, but they've said it's been exceeding their expectations. And so I think that combined with some of this other analysis says that Apple's doing just fine with smartwatches. Rumors have been swirling around for a while now about a new electric vehicle company that people claim wants to take on Tesla, and this time around, it's not Apple, or at least maybe it's not. The company is called Faraday Future, and it was launched about 18 months ago in Gardenia, California. Well, this week, there was news that surfaced that the company plans to spend $1 billion on a new U.S. factory to start producing vehicles by 2017, and they're looking at sites in California, Georgia, Nevada, and Louisiana. There was also a report that the team that they have assembled is about 400 people, and they have members culled from other car companies, including companies like Tesla. So if a lot of these plans sound mysteriously familiar, it's because a lot of these plans have been said about Apple and their rumored car project as well. And so what happened was, when these rumors started surfacing, a lot of people started to try and want to make connections to Apple, saying that this maybe is just a front company and it's part of Apple's secret car project. But don't jump too far to conclusions, because Bloomberg looked into this a little bit, and it seems like Faraday is actually backed by a Chinese billionaire, a guy they say basically runs Chinese Netflix, a TV movie style service in China. And he's actually funding this and wants to put together this car company. But I have to say, it's a great story, because it means things are getting really interesting in this car space. And we might have, you know, kind of three main electric car companies in this race fairly soon. And none of these companies are coming out of traditional car places like Detroit, Japan, or Germany. I find this very, very interesting, and it really could push the technology forward. And it's going to be interesting to see Tesla finally getting some competition in this space, and not just from Apple, but it sounds like also from this Chinese company. Apple does itself continue to apparently hire people that indicate more and more that they're working on some sort of car technology, or at least that they want to. This week, there was a report that they hired a guy, and I'm going to totally butcher his name, but we'll give it a try here. Ronan O'Brien, who is most recently the director of engineering at a company called Rever. And what was interesting about Reviver, what was interesting about Reviver is that they make digital license plates that can monitor a vehicle's location, store maintenance records, send digital payments for tolls or parking fees, and also have the ability to track things like the current registration status, and can apparently feed data to law enforcement, say during a traffic stop. So, smart license plate. And it's not clear if Apple hired him because they want to add digital license plate technology into their car. I think that's probably not likely. I think they probably have other plans for Ronan. He just says in his LinkedIn listing that he's going to be working on secret projects at Apple, but certainly is still more evidence that Apple at the very least has cars on the mind. I really personally think there's no doubt at this point that Apple is working on some sort of car project. How that is going to actually manifest itself in the future, will we be all driving around in iCars? Maybe someday. I might like to, but I wouldn't be betting a whole lot of money on it. I again think that a lot of the technology that they could develop for a car-based project actually has other applications. I think Apple definitely wants to. If they can pull it off, I think it'll be very, very cool. But if it doesn't happen, I don't think it's, you know, R&D money wasted or anything like that. I think they're going to be able to reapply that technology elsewhere. So I think it's a good move and good plans for them all the way around. And then finally, in the news for this week, we have some iPad sales data that's very interesting from a company called Localytics. They claim that the iPad 2, the iPad Mini, the original version, and the iPad Air, the original version, were the most commonly used models of iPad in October. Basically, they monitor web traffic and usage of various devices, and they found that those three models represented the most seen or most used devices on the web. And that is more evidence that seems to point to the fact that despite Apple releasing newer models of iPads, many people who have them already are sticking with their earlier models and not upgrading. And as you know, we've been talking about, that's a little bit concerning to Apple and is a big reason why Apple has seen declining iPad sales. I really call it sort of the problem of making a device that's just too darn good. The iPads are great, and you can get a lot of utility out of them for a very long time. You don't need to buy new iPads every year. And that's particularly why I think a new model or a new variant of the iPad that hits a new market is really important for Apple. Something like the iPad Pro that can bring in new buyers, maybe more folks in the enterprise, more artists, breaking into regions where Apple maybe hasn't typically sold an iPad for a specific application. So that could go a long way into slowing declining sales and perhaps more appropriately generate more iPad revenue because of the higher price point of that specific device. But a lot of people are wondering, when am I going to be able to buy an iPad Pro? When can I get my hands on one? And last week, we started to have some rumors that Apple would be shipping units to stores on November 11th. So as I record this podcast, in just 2 days, this Wednesday. Yet there were some other signs that surfaced later that showed that maybe Friday, November 13th would be the day. As a matter of fact, both Sam's Club and Mac Mall announced that they were taking pre-orders for a device that would release on Friday the 13th of November. Well, it turns out that both of those rumors in a way were true because Apple announced just today, just this morning, Monday morning, that they would begin taking online orders on Wednesday and that iPad Pro sales would begin at Apple retail stores and at select Apple authorized resellers later this week. They didn't give any more firm date than that. Many of us are assuming that means Friday, but seems like Apple left themselves a little bit open as to when those might actually show up in a retail store. They also said in the same press release that the Apple Pencil and the Smart Keyboard accessories would also be available to order online on Wednesday, but did not mention if they will release at the same time. I assume that they're going to be available at the same time, but very often Apple's PR wording, I think, is deliberate. So the fact that they didn't specifically say that they would be available, quote unquote, later in the week is a little bit of a concern to someone like me who was hoping to buy the whole package. And I'm a little bit confused on what I'm going to do, if I will actually try and pre-order or wait to see if the sales, you know, iPad Pros are on sale in the retail stores on Friday and then just go and pick one up. I don't think demand is going to be as huge as prior generation models have been, but Apple is launching the iPad Pro in 40 countries simultaneously this week. So that includes the US, Canada, UK, Ireland, Australia, China, and a bunch of other countries. And we have been hearing that Apple really hasn't geared up a large production run, at least in this initial run. And I think that's probably because they're trying to gauge, you know, how many of these things are we actually going to sell? They don't want to have too many on hand, depending upon how sales go. So it's a little bit of this wait and see going on. Pricing starts at $799 US. That's for the 32 gigabyte model, $949 US for a 128 gigabyte iPad Pro, and $1,079 US for the 128 gigabyte Wi-Fi with cellular model. The Apple Pencil is going to be $99 US, and the Smart Keyboard is $169 US in charcoal gray, and it is only one color for the Smart Keyboard, at least at launch. I fully expect at some point in the future, Apple's going to offer up other versions of maybe the Pencil and the keyboard and various colors and things like that. I think it's a safe bet to say at some point they'll probably have a product red version. But if you want to get an iPad Pro, they are going on sale this week, Wednesday, for pre-orders online. And Apple did not give a time, so we don't really know. Typically at midnight is when you can start ordering, or you may be able to pick one up in a retail store over the weekend. If you want one on launch day, I'm betting that, you know, a pre-order may or may not be the way to go, just based on how the Apple TV sales went. A lot of us ordered Apple TVs pre-order. They didn't arrive on Friday, and it was much easier just to go into a retail store and pick one up. I think that might be the case this time around as well. But again, because Apple's given that open-ended end of the week time frame, who knows when? Will it be Friday? Will it be Saturday? And where does Apple define the end of the week? Does Sunday count? I don't really know. Either option's looking like not going to be a guarantee that you'll get one on day one. And again, some online resellers are already taking pre-orders, including places like Mac Mall, but they're looking to be not your best bet at this point because Mac Mall says they don't expect to ship orders until November 16th, and places like Staples are listing a launch date of November 25th. So if you really want to get it day one, it's, you know, going to be an Apple retail store or a pre-order on Wednesday. It's also possible you might be able to walk into some third-party resellers that have brick-and-mortar locations like Target or Best Buy, but currently they're both listing iPad Pros, or actually, I guess Target's not listing them at all, rather, when I went to check, and Best Buy is listing it as coming soon steals still. So they haven't given a firm date, and it's not mentioned in Apple's press release when third-party authorized resellers will get them, just that some will, and they're not saying who or which ones or anything like that. So again, we are having another launch, I think, where there is a lot of confusion on the specifics, and you're probably going to have to form your own game plan based on this information. In case you want to know what I'm thinking about doing right now, I'm thinking that I am just going to head to an Apple retail store on Friday morning and take my chances with that and not do the pre-order this time around, just because I have such a sour experience after pre-ordering an Apple TV and because Apple has left that open-ended time frame. So that's what I'm doing. And with that, that is going to be the news for this week. I want to talk a little more about the Apple TV. Specifically, with the new Apple TV out now, they are offering some pretty compelling features, including a lot of the various apps that you can get that really turn it into a full-fledged media center, game console. It can do a lot more than prior generation Apple TVs could. And that has prompted Brian to email into me and ask for a comparison, because you know, if you've been listening to the MacCast for a while, we have our dear Darian from the HD TV podcast on from time to time to talk about using a Mac Mini as a home theater solution. And that was something, you know, in the early days, that's kind of what we had to do, Brian, because we didn't have Apple TV. And when the Apple TV came out, that whole paradigm changed a little bit. But still, you know, your question is about, what are the advantages or disadvantages? Is there any reason to continue to use like an old Mac Mini as a home theater system? And the first question is, what are the advantages and disadvantages other than cost? Obviously, a Mac Mini is going to cost you a little bit more. Although, if you got a used one, if you got an older one, which functions perfectly fine as a media center, the cost could be somewhat comparable. I think the main advantage of the Apple TV really is the simplicity, the consistent and really good user experience, the 10-foot user experience for the living room, the maintenance, the setup. You know, it's plug and play. You buy the unit, you take it home, you plug it into your TV with HDMI cable, and you're pretty much good to go. It's really that whole iOS experience, or in this case, tvOS experience versus macOS. It's specifically designed to do the thing that you're trying to use it for. With a Mac Mini, really what you're doing is you're taking a desktop computer and sort of forcing it into your home entertainment center. And what that means with the Mac Mini is it's going to be a lot more, what I would say, fiddly. You're going to have to tweak with it a little bit. And the experience is really going to be something that you're going to have to find solutions for and tune. Specifically, like, there is no really screen control for a 10-foot interface. You're going to be dealing with the finder in your living room, and that means probably a mouse and a keyboard, or a trackpad and a keyboard. And you can kind of get some cool accessories to plug those things together and pair it up and have an easy way to kind of navigate from across the room, but still things are going to be a little bit small. You're going to have to click on icons and move a cursor around. It does get a little bit tricky. Now, the advantage with using something like a Mac Mini is there's a lot more flexibility in terms of hacking. You can do a lot more things. Another advantage for some people is going to be the fact that, unlike the new Apple TV, a Mac Mini does have a digital optical out. So if you need to go into a stereo with a digital optical system, Mac Mini is going to be able to do that. And then you do have the flexibility for other applications, things like Plex, although Plex is now on the Apple TV, and it's a pretty good experience. But we talked earlier about web browsers. Web browsers might never come to the Apple TV. So if you want to use a web browser and you have a Mac Mini hooked up to your Apple TV, that's pretty easy to do. And you could use built-in Safari, but there's even browsers that are specifically tuned for a TV experience, something like the Kylo browser. So you have that flexibility to kind of mix and match and add in different components and really customize the experience with the Mac Mini. Whereas with the Apple TV, at least through the third gen, right, you're kind of locked into Apple's experience. Now with apps, it's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic changes. You're going to have a few other options. to do that. Now, another question Brian asked about is, you know, what about AirPlay? Can you push AirPlay to a Mac? So can I AirPlay stuff from my iPad to my Mac? Yes, absolutely. There's apps out there like AirServer, and this would be something you'd want to install on a Mac Mini if you were using it as a home theater PC. And with AirServer, that just basically turns your Mac into an AirPlay location that you can send stuff to. With music, I think you could use AirServer for that as well. But for music specifically, you could use an app like AirFoil with AirFoil speakers that's made by Rogue Amoeba. And that basically gives you the ability to send audio from all kinds of devices to an Apple TV and vice versa. I mean, you can kind of go any which way once you start getting into the whole AirFoil speaker solution. And the nice thing about that is it even works with Windows PCs as well. So if you have those in your environment, you can do that. Now, you don't even need to go that far, of course, if you're using a Mac Mini as a home theater, because you could also just access all your music from iTunes and Spotify and RDO, all the dedicated applications that you could install on a Mac. You could, of course, just use directly from a Mac Mini. And then I think the last question, Brian, that you had was, you know, what about things like the channels like NBC, ESPN, HBO Go, Hulu, Netflix? If you're using a Mac Mini, how would you do that with your television? And, you know, the web is the way to go. You would use a web browser, either, you know, a dedicated TV browser like Kylo browser or just Safari. And you could pull up any of the web interfaces for those services. There also are some channels and content that you could get for third-party systems like Plex or Xbox Media Center. Although in looking at those when I was investigating them, they do seem to be limited to the stuff that's made available publicly. So you can't really log into an account with those channels within those, you know, other sort of media streamer applications. You can't really authorize to get things like live content or almost live content or even get to any of the back catalog stuff. They seem to me to be a little bit kludgy because they're not official apps that are, I think, being generated by the different stations. So on the Apple TV, you're going to have that advantage of, you know, there is an NBC app made by NBC and an ABC app and an HBO app and all of those things. So at the end of all of this, I think this is maybe a really long way of just saying, I really think that the new Apple TV is going to be your best Apple-based living room experience for now. It beats using a Mac Mini on price point. And now with the applications, I think almost anything that you would have wanted to cobble together with a Mac Mini, you're going to be able to do with an Apple TV. So the only reason I could see now to use a Mac Mini is if you really wanted to do some experimenting or tinkering, mess around with other things, or really wanted to have a lot of sort of hacking flexibility. It's almost like the jailbreak way to go, I guess, versus jailbreaking your Apple TV, right? Just use a Mac Mini and it'll kind of let you do anything you want. But more and more these days, I think there's very few things that you can accomplish with a Mac Mini that you can't also accomplish with the new Apple TV and a couple apps. So for me, I think Apple TV is a clear winner. I was browsing over The Loop this week, and I ran across a really cool article that was posted on a site called Mac Kung Fu. And it had a little tip related to the Apple Watch that I had never heard before. And what they lay out is how some of the notification icons on the watch, you will notice, have a round icon, and other notifications will feature a square icon. That's up in the little banner. I think Apple calls it the sash up at the top of the notification. And they say that if it's round, it's because you have the Apple Watch version of the app installed, and that means that you can actually take action on that notification, or rather click on it and have that show up in the specific application that you received the notification from. And that if it's the square icon, it means it's a notification that is just being echoed from your Apple Watch, so purely informational. You're not going to be able to click on that and go through to anything else. Now, they do also point out that sometimes with Apple's own mail application, you'll get a square icon, meaning that you can't take action on it. And that may seem strange because obviously the Apple Mail app is installed on the watch by default. But they say the reason for that is that the message is either not in your inbox or it's not in the mailbox that you have configured or set up in the iPhone's watch app for notifications. And so I thought this was a pretty cool tip and I wanted to share it. I wanted to do a little investigating and make sure it really was a thing. Unfortunately, I cannot find it documented anywhere in Apple's official documentation. I took a look at the Apple Watch user guide. It's not mentioned in there. And I even went so far as to look at the developer human interface guidelines for the Apple Watch. And I can't find any reference to it in there. But, you know, logically, it makes sense. I just can't remember if I've ever seen actually a square icon on an Apple Watch notification. So I bring it up for you. Keep an eye out, take a look, and see if this really is a thing. Because if it is, I think it's actually a cool little indicator of, you know, what's an actionable notification on the Apple Watch and what's just purely informational. Terry wrote in this week to say, unfortunately, he's been having issues with El Capitan. I think I asked last time for comments on how your upgrades have been going. I finally did the upgrade myself, and I've ran into a few little issues, maybe not as bad as what you're experiencing, Terry. He says that he's been getting beach balls after just about a month of use, so that the upgrade went fine, but after using it for a month or so, he's starting to see a lot of beach balls show up on his system, even after the OS X 10.11.1 update. That didn't seem to fix anything. And mentions that it starts with beach balls in Safari that then sort of spill over into all of the other applications, getting to a point where it's so bad that every app is beach balling and only a restart will fix it. And then it'll be fine for a certain period of time, but then the beach balling will slowly come back and start spiraling out of control. And that kind of stinks. I'm not happy to hear that, Terry. But Terry also did ask, well, you know, if I can't get this resolved, I have a super duper clone of my original OS X Yosemite, but it's now about a month old. So how can I actually roll that back and not lose a month of work? And unfortunately, Terry, while it can be done, it is a somewhat tedious process. It's not too bad, but you have to just think about some things before you just sort of roll back and do that. So yeah, you could boot off your old super duper clone and then simply clone it back over top of your El Capitan upgrade. Unfortunately, you would lose a bunch of data in the process, right? You're going to lose a month's worth of work. So what you're going to want to do is actually make a backup of at least your home folder, but you probably just want to make another super duper backup of your current El Capitan upgrade. I'm assuming it's something you probably have already. And then set that aside, do the restore back, and then you're going to sort of need to sync everything back over from El Capitan. And it's really kind of just manually copying over certain specific folders and data. If you use iCloud syncing for bookmarks and contacts and calendars, that stuff's going to be really easy. All of that's just going to come back when you set up those accounts and log into iCloud. If all of your email accounts are only IMAP, then you just log back into those, right? And it's just going to IMAP sync everything back from your servers. If you're using POP accounts, you will need to take the extra step of probably going in and exporting out all of the POP email that you have gathered for the past month and set that aside as well so that you can re-import that back into your mail accounts. But then with the other stuff, things like photos and your iTunes music and your documents, you should be able to just simply copy those folders back from your current El Capitan backup and overwrite the ones that were restored from your super duper backup of OS X Yosemite. So you just literally manually copy them one over the top of the other and have them replace the ones that are there. Any applications, of course, that you installed or updated in that month would need to be reinstalled or re-updated. And the only other thing I think you might potentially lose is maybe some of your settings or app preferences, but it shouldn't be too bad to have to go back in and just sort of reset those up. And I think that's all the major points, and I'm not missing any. Of course, keep around the El Capitan backup as you're, you know, running through back into Yosemite, just in case you missed something or you need to restore something or recover something, you can do that. And especially if you just make a bootable super duper clone or a carbon copy cloner clone, it shouldn't be too hard to be able to get back in and get at any files or any data that might have been left behind. But it shouldn't be too bad of a process. Now, that being said, I wouldn't be too quick to just downgrade from El Capitan back into OS X Yosemite, at least not before trying a few things. And what I would advise you to do is when you start to see the beach balling, take a look at the activity monitor and look at CPU usage, memory usage, even network usage, and see if you can see what might be causing things to spin out of control. What's using a lot of the processor or a lot of the memory when that's going on, or what's using a lot of the network? You'd be surprised more and more how many applications rely on network connectivity, and when things go wrong with your internet or your network connection, it can slow the whole system down. I'm noticing this more and more, and it's actually pretty annoying. But more recently, an example of that I had is when I did my upgrade and turned back on iCloud Photo Library, that completely wrecked and destroyed my network and slowed everything down because it was trying to, you know, re-upload everything. And I was having some sort of issue. So it even got so bad to the point that I've completely turned off iCloud Photo Library on all of my devices, and I'm considering just using Flickr for my online photos because the syncing of that works just fine and I've never had an issue with. I'm also thinking that maybe because I did a clean install of OS X El Capitan that might have led to some of my issues where I manually copied over my iCloud or my photo library rather. And maybe just resetting that and starting from scratch with iCloud Photo Library might resolve it. I'm a little gun-shy at this point, so I haven't flipped the switch to turn it back on, just because even the first time around, iCloud Photo Library did cause so much network traffic that it really impacted other things that I like to do. And it's hard to remember to go back in and just turn it on at night when everybody's asleep so that it can do its thing. But I would check there. I would also check the console application. So go into Applications Utilities and launch the console app and take a look at the messages, specifically the all messages log or the diagnostic and usage areas, and look for any patterns of errors, specifically for things that are erroring out. Expand the little info triangles and see if you can't pinpoint what might be causing that beach ball to happen. Another thing that happened to me recently after upgrading to El Capitan is I noticed that I had a bunch of errors from a process that looked like it was related to iCloud Keychain. And once I went in and just turned off iCloud Keychain and then turned it back on, it seemed to resolve a lot of the errors that I was seeing. And that thing was filling up my error log, again, causing some problems on my system. I don't know if it directly led to beach balls, because I haven't seen a lot of beach balls in El Capitan, but it certainly was something that I wanted to clean out and take care of. And so a lot of times, between activity monitor and console, you can get a lot of good troubleshooting done, and you may not have to do the whole rollback. And then a final little tip that I would have for you is boot into recovery mode. So restart your Mac, hold down Command R so that you boot into the recovery partition, and then launch Disk Utility and just check and possibly repair your disks. Sometimes things can get a little out of whack, and maybe there's just some indexing or some issues going on with the hard drive, and just fixing up those will kind of take care of some of the problems that you're having. The other thing that I was having a discussion with Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer and Mac Geek Gab about is that he has noticed both in OS X Yosemite and in El Capitan that spindle drives, if you have spinning drives, there seems to be a lot more kind of resources going on, specifically related to disk writes and paging that's happening, and that seems to impact those people running machines with spinning hard drives, and a lot of times just a reboot will solve that. But once again, I think like the experience that you're having, it will build back up over time. So in a couple days' time or more, you start to see the problems again and you have to reboot. So if you are experiencing that, maybe it's the kind of thing where even though a lot of us like to leave our Macs on full time and just have them go to sleep and then wake them up, maybe it's the kind of thing where you want to have it turn off at night and turn back on. And you could even use something like the Energy Saver Schedule to just turn it off and then turn it back on at a certain point in the middle of the night so it doesn't really impact maybe some of your scheduled tasks and backups and things like that. Just another thing to try. You really shouldn't have to do that. And hopefully if that is a bug, it's something that Apple addresses in a future update. But some people have been complaining about that for a little while, and I just thought I'd mention that as a possible source to look into as well. But good luck, and hopefully one of these solutions works for you. In a prior episode, I already expressed some of my frustrations with the online appointment booking system for the Genius Bar. It used to be something that was really efficient, really great to use. I used it all the time when I had to go in and talk to Apple about an issue I was having with an iOS device or my Mac. But now, if at least you use the one on Apple's website, it seems to be forcing you to go through kind of like a troubleshooting wizard where it tries to figure out what your issue is and tries to take you into an Apple support article or a discussion thread or something on Apple's website and really tries to seem to steer you away from actually talking to a human being, either calling Apple support or going into an Apple retail store. And while I get why they're doing that, they're trying to sort of weed out common problems that could be solved by simply searching the Apple support forums or the Apple support website. Those of us who have been around and doing this stuff for a while have typically already gone through that process. I've searched Google. I've searched, you know, the Stack Overflow discussions. I've searched Apple discussion boards. I've done all of those things. So usually at that point, I'm really to the point where I really just want to get in there and make an appointment. And luckily, the workaround for this right now is to use the Apple Store app on your iOS device. It has a direct, straightforward process still, but I'm a little bit worried at some point Apple's going to also change that process to kind of direct you more towards the support articles. And you have that going on there. We've already discussed that a little bit, but recently Jill pointed out something that I've noticed as well, and she discovered that even if you get to the appointments area where you can actually set an appointment, actually getting an appointment is proving to be more and more difficult. As Apple's products become more and more popular, as they gain more customers, there's just not enough geniuses, I don't think, at the Genius Bars to be able to serve all of the customers that want appointments. In Jill's particular case, she sent me an email and pointed out that she has 9 Apple stores in her vicinity, things, you know, Apple stores that she can actually get to. Was trying to make an appointment, I think, for an iPhone, and every single appointment was booked up for several days. Occasionally, I've noticed you can get lucky and there's an opening the day that you're trying to make the appointment, but it's more and more becoming that you have to wait at least 12 to 24 hours, if not really days, before you can actually get in and get an appointment. And I have noticed that Mac appointments seem to be easier to get than iPad appointments or iPhone. iPhone appointments seem to be the ones that are the most difficult to get. And, you know, that sort of tracks with how Apple sells devices. They sell more iPhones than anything else these days. So a lot of people trying to get in and get support with their iPhones. And in my last visit to the Genius Bar, actually the geniuses themselves seemed keenly aware of this problem. As a matter of fact, I was told by the guy who was helping me that they've been being asked by Apple to start taking 2 or 3 customers at a time. So it used to be that you would go in and you would just have your appointment and the genius would just be working with you. But because they've got so many demands, they're asking to sort of juggle between customers and take 2 or 3 at a time. And initially that sounds kind of bad, like something they shouldn't be doing. But when you think about it, in many cases, there are long periods during the support that you're getting where they could be off helping another customer. Things like, hey, have you backed up your iOS device? We have to take this in. No, you haven't. Okay, well, let's let you connect it to our network and do a backup or do a restore of your device. Or oftentimes it's running through a diagnostic and it needs to sit there and run a hardware diagnostic for 15, 20 minutes. Well, they certainly could jump over and help another customer during that period. And that's what they're being asked to do to kind of deal with this volume. I also think they've started moving the appointments closer together. I seem to remember them being about 20 minutes to a half hour apart. I think they're down to about 15 minutes apart at this point. But, you know, the trouble is that for many of us, by the time we have determined we need a Genius Bar appointment, really we need it now, right? You've worked through all the other troubleshooting. You're at a, hey, my system is completely broken. I really need this fixed right now because I can't fix it myself. I need help. Let's get a genius in here. And so this ability to not get a same day appointment is really, really frustrating. And that was what Jill wrote me to talk about. And more, I'm personally becoming convinced that the best thing to do these days, rather than make an appointment anymore, is simply do a walk-in. Actually, that's not 100% true. I would check online and see if you can get an appointment, because if you have one, then you know you're set. But if that doesn't work for you and you need assistance immediately, pick your local closest Apple retail store, or maybe the one you know that's a little less busy. Like I have one particularly in my region that's at a specific mall that tends to be less crowded than some of the other retail stores. I will go to that store and just try to get a walk-in appointment. And Apple has actually accounted for this recently, and they can often really squeeze you in. And that process seems to be very streamlined. They can look up what's going on. They can see how many appointments they have. They can give you an estimated time of when they might be able to see you on a walk-in appointment. And what I've found more and more, it's usually within the hour or within a couple of hours. So what I do is I plan around that. And if there's other shopping or other errands I can do in the area at the same time, that's when I'll go down to the Apple store and try and get a walk-in appointment. Because what they do, the process that they use, is they take your name, they tell you an approximate time when you might have an appointment or how long the wait is, really, and then they take your cell phone number and they will give you notifications throughout the process. So at first, when they first set up the appointment, you get a notification, yes, you have, you know, you're waiting in line for a walk-in appointment. And then they will give you a text message when they're almost ready for you, I think about 15 or 20 minutes before. And that's when you can start to head back to the Apple retail store. So you don't have to wait around there if they know it's going to be, you know, about an hour wait or an hour and a half wait. They can say it's approximately that. You can go out, do some things, run some of those errands, and you'll get these text messages. So it's, oh, okay, they're going to be ready for me in about 15 minutes. You don't want to go too far away. So as you're planning your errands, you know, make sure you're within about a 20-minute drive of the Apple store. But when you get that message, start heading back. And then once you get there, they will give you another text message when they're actually ready to see you. And then you can go up to the concierge there, say, here, I'm here for my appointment, and they will get you in. That really does seem to be the best way to go about it. So Jill, I would advise try that in the future if you've run into the same problem where you can't get an appointment. And then just another few quick tips before you get in, things to know about, because I've gone in and had to go away because I forgot to do some of these things. Always make sure that you have backups of your Mac or your device. Be ready that they may need to take it in for service, so you might have to hand it over. So you may want to do things like log out of Find My iPhone or iCloud, especially if they're going to replace your device. Have that done already. Be willing to hand over your login password. If you don't want to do that, the thing that I do is I often just change it before I go in, or just take it out completely, knowing that they're going to have to work on it. And there's always a possibility that they might replace your device or replace the hard drive in your Mac. And some people feel very sensitive about their data. So if you're worried about that and you're not using something like File Vault, you may consider just pre-erasing the hard drive. So do your backup. And sometimes what I do is completely erase the hard drive, install just the operating system on it. And very often that's one of the troubleshooting steps they want you to do with a Mac anyway, right? They're going to ask you, have you reinstalled the operating system? Have you started over from scratch with your iOS device? And if you haven't, they will sometimes ask you to do that first before they give you additional service. So you can just do that ahead of time, bring it in, just say, look, I've already tried it. It's still having the problem. And, you know, then you're ready for them to take it in, and you don't have to worry about any of your personal data should they decide they need to replace your device or replace your hard drive. So just a few other things to think about before you go in for a Genius Bar appointment. And thank you, Jill, for sending in your comment. And then lastly for today, you know, Apple's branded cables, their lightning cables, their power adapters, their headphones, you know, they all have this sort of nice thin cable, and the sleeve on it has a nice velvety soft touch. They feel like a premium cable. But I think many of us find that over time they have some issues and they don't hold up very well. I don't think this is any secret. I don't think I'm revealing any big revelation. And Jim sent me an email to say that it seems like now in his family, they have to replace at least 3 sets of Apple headphones, 5 lightning cables, and a MacBook power supply every year. And he's now concerned that they're going to have to be replacing Apple Watch cables every year as well. I'm not so sure on the Apple Watch cable, Jim. I guess it depends on how much traveling you do with it. But the point is well taken, right? The Apple cables seem to have this wear and tear problem, specifically around the area where the connectors are. And even if you are really easygoing on your cables, Jim mentioned that he is. I know that I'm very delicate with my cables. I try not very hard not to kink them. I don't think this is an issue. I've had cables fail they basically at that joint will sort of start to crack over time or bunch up or bend or fray. I have a bunch of cables where it's not broken, but if you look at the area around the connector, it's almost like it's scrunched up, like the sleeve has pushed up against the connector itself, and it's sort of like bunching up almost like a rug, you know, if you slid on it and it sort of collapsed together. And there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there that say Apple has deliberately designed cables that would fail over time so that you have to buy new ones, and that generates for Apple, because Apple cables aren't cheap, you know, in any way, shape, or form. But I'm not sure that I absolutely buy that. I think Apple's trying to make the best quality cable that they have. They can, but I think they also like the fact that their cables are thin and they wind up nicely and they go into a bag nicely. But thin isn't always the best thing, I think, for durability. And I've tried some other non-Apple made for iPhone cables from various manufacturers, and a lot of those have some of the same issues over time. So this just might be a general thing where, you know what, cables wear out, especially the ones that we use every day and we're constantly plugging and unplugging. I have found that, you know, the ones that stay on my desktop and are always plugged in, those generally don't have issues. It's the ones where it's the charging station for everybody in the family, or it's the cable that I take with me on the road, or it's my power supply cable where I'm constantly plugging and unplugging that thing, no matter how delicate I am with them. And to kind of solve the solution, Jim, I think the best compromise that I've found is to use thicker cables, but they tend to have some disadvantages as well. So I like the ones from Anker. I have some good Amazon basic cables in terms of lightning cables, and they're all made for iPhone certified. But the trade-off is that they really don't roll up as nicely for travel, and they don't feel quite as good. They're stiff, and you know, if you're trying to use them when they're plugged in, it sometimes feels like they might be, you know, pulling down on the connector a little bit harder than you would really want. And the Anker ones specifically, which are pretty thick, have developed some odd kinking for me. It doesn't seem to be a problem, but they just don't, they're not nice, supple, sort of looping cables. They have a firmness to them. And I think that adds to their durability and longevity, but it also has some disadvantages as well. So there's that. I know some people, because the Apple ones tend to have this weak point around the connectors, they've worked on a number of hacks and fixes that you can try. Just search Amazon or Google for Apple cable hacks, and you'll find a bunch of different sort of tips and tricks. I even went so far on Amazon as to have bought a set of clip protectors that sort of clip on the end of the cable and add a little more protection in that area where it can't sort of bend and flex, but it alters just the style of the cable and makes it a little less flexible, right? Another thing I've seen is there's this stuff called Shugru, which is like this moldable plastic stuff that you can buy, and people will mold that on there. It's got a softness to it, but it's also, you know, a little firmer. So at the connector, you kind of mush this stuff on there and extend it out a little bit and shore up that connection. There's also people who will use the spring from a Click ballpoint pen. So, you know, those clicky ballpoint pens, you can pull them apart. There's a little spring there. They will wrap that around the end of the connector to sort of extend wear and shore up, make it a little bit firmer at that end so it can't flex as much if it gets pulled on, or it flexes more gently, I guess is probably the better way to put that. But the key seems to be to add something around the area of the connector to prevent it from bending at a really strong angle. But I'm also not entirely convinced that that just doesn't move the breakpoint down further, depending upon how you're using your cables. And also how you wrap them up makes a big deal as well. I know, you know, one thing that I constantly worry about is Apple's own wrapping solution that comes on their little power cables for laptops. And I'm convinced that a lot of those fail because of Apple's own design, because where you sort of wrap that around, it pulls pretty tight on the wire that's coming out of the brick itself. So I'm always very careful to make sure that the wire is pointing straight out and it's not being pulled to the left or right before I wrap the cable around. But again, that makes it a little less portable because the cable wire is sticking straight out a little bit further than you might like, and it probably still gets bent over when you're cramming it into a laptop bag or something like that. So I think that's a lot of the reasons why it's happening. I don't necessarily buy that Apple's cables are a lower quality, or they're trying to make them lower quality on purpose so that we have to buy more. I think it's just a factor of we use this stuff, we carry it around, and cables will eventually wear out. But if anybody else has other solutions, other tips or tricks, other brands of cables that you might recommend that seem to hold up maybe better than what Apple offers, specifically, I would be looking for something that has the feel of the Apple brand, has the sort of ability to roll up nicely and not be really firm and stiff, but still has maybe a little bit more durability. And I don't know if that's even possible. But if you have something like that, shoot us an email, a comment, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of their software at smilesoftware.com/maccast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on our call-in hotline. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That is at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, the Twitters, the Facebookies, the Google Pluses, you can find me all of those places. On Twitter, it's twitter.com/maccast. The MacCast Facebook page is over at facebook.com/themaccast. And you'll find the Google Plus channel or page on google.com/plusMaccast, and that's the plus symbol. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.